Blog Talk Radio. Good morning and welcome to Solutions Live Business Edition. I'm your host, Chickie Fitzgerald, and we're going to be talking about innovation, leadership, investment insights, and growth this morning. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, and I am just so excited to bring to you this new venture called Solutions Live. Again, my name is Chickie Fitzgerald, and I'm coming to you from sunny Tampa, Florida, with an outstanding lineup today. We're going to start with Nancy Widman, who is with a group called the Guru Nation, and I'm going to come back to her in a second. Chris Dane will be our guest at 11 o'clock. Chris and I are going to continue a dialogue that we started on Fox Business Money for Breakfast a couple of weeks ago, talking about investment in the cruise line industry. And then we're going to wrap up at 11:30 with Libby Gill. And Libby is a branding expert, probably most noted for her time in helping to launch the Dr. Phil show and the Dr. Phil brand. So looking forward to coming back to that in a minute. And now I would like to welcome my first guest to the show, Nancy Widman.
Good morning.
Good morning, Nancy.
It's
What's
great
the weather
to be
like
here.
In New York?
It just started to snow. So we're expecting another storm, Chickie.
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, we've got cold weather here in Tampa, but I know better than to complain about our kind of cold.
You bet. We've had a hard winter.
Yeah, you guys have. We had, obviously, a gorgeous day on Sunday for the Super Bowl. And
yes,
then yesterday,
you did. Yes, you
I
did. Looked great.
Yesterday it was cold and rainy, and we were so glad that that weather held off. And now today we've got another beautiful day. Well, I really appreciate you being part of this inaugural event. You know, I think it's really momentous, certainly for me, to have someone who I consider to be a broadcast pioneer. And I don't know if you like that term or not, but you were clearly a very moving force in the CBS radio development. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background so that I get all the dates right?
Great. Thank you, Chickie. I'm not at all uncomfortable with the term pioneer. I used to be, but not anymore. Although it does sort of have an image of sitting in a buckboard with a little white cap on. But I started my career in sales, in radio. 25 years at CBS. I had some wonderful jobs. I look back with great pleasure and joy. I started selling radio time in the 70s, then moved up to the company into sales management, and the very most fun job I had was WCBS-FM. I ran a radio station, a great oldies radio station, for 6 years, then put another foot on the ladder and moved up to running the stations division, and finally for 8 wonderful years, was president of CBS Radio. We had stations all over the country, news talk and rock and roll, and boy, that's an old term, right? Rock and roll. oldies. And
well, it was called rock and roll before it was called oldies.
Yes, exactly. And now I think it's still called rock and roll. It was a fabulously exciting time. I was paving the way, I hope, and putting some dents in the glass ceiling. I was the first woman to hold every job that I held at CBS. So those were long, exciting, innovating years. Subsequently, after CBS, I co-authored a book with two other women called I Didn't See It Coming, How to Avoid Being Blindsided in Business, which was published last year, 2 years ago, by Wiley in 2007. And it basically is a survival guide. That's kind of the best way.
Yeah, and I want to come back and talk a little bit of that about that in our second half hour when we talk about leadership. But
great.
You know, I think in our first topic, which is about innovation, you know, you've clearly set the stage here of talking about the early days of your involvement in radio, and you know, especially being responsible for advertising sales. Because as I've talked to people about launching the Solutions Live Broadcasting Network, you know, they kind of look at me like I'm a little bit crazy. It's like, well, where are you going to get your audience? And I said, well, you know, right now I'm focusing on the content. And, you know, I'm just blessed to have such amazing people available to me, authors and experts. And you know, I lined up this morning one of the guys who was a leader in one of the key battles in Afghanistan to be on my show about leadership when his new book comes out in April. And, you know, when I just think about this, you know, first of all, I tell them, you know, it's really different than the early days of radio when, you know, a show was truly perishable and your advertising inventory was perishable, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we certainly learned with the ads in the Super Bowl that will continue to go on, which will continue to go on and on and on with these wonderful commercials because they have so many other platforms.
Yes.
And in the music business and in the radio business, all kinds of different ways of reaching the consumer have developed, whether it be through the computer or and many different ways. So nothing is perishable anymore. It can be packaged
right.
and a bow put on it and sold so many times over. Where
right.
that's what's so exciting about this time.
Yeah, I think so too. And you know, last week I think I told you I did a 3-day series called Transition Solutions. Excuse me, about helping people who are either in transition and unemployed, those who are self-employed and questioning whether they should stay self-employed,
right.
and those that are kind of holding their breath to see if they're next. And it was really interesting because, again, somebody asked me about, you know, the actual people who had listened to the show live. And I said, well, you know, those numbers weren't what I would have liked. But the cool thing is I can go back now with the Blog Talk Radio platform, and I can actually look at how many people have downloaded it since. And that's what really gets me excited is the viral nature of this kind of a platform. So I am just delighted to share the launch of this platform with you. And I'd like to turn our eyes to innovation when the sky is falling,
how
which is what you
that?
And Hagai agreed to talk about today.
Well, when you think of the subject of innovating when the sky is falling, people might have a tendency to say, why and how? Because this is a time when you do feel filled with anxiety and concern and kind of when you're working for a company, you almost want to hunker down and say, if I can just ride this storm out, maybe I'll survive. Well, that's exactly wrong. If you look at the subject innovating when the sky is falling, and you look at what innovating means, by definition, it simply means creating or introducing something new, or, and this is even more important, a new way to do something.
Right.
So this is a perfect time to be an innovator. Not only is it a perfect time, I contend that you have to innovate. You have to innovate if you're a leader and you're running a company. You can't do things the same old way. You can't do things the way you did even 2 years ago. Certainly
right.
not 5 years ago.
I think even one quarter.
Even one quarter, exactly. And
I was talking to a friend yesterday, and she said, well, you know, it's like everybody's paralyzed, Chickie. And I said, well, no, I think it's even worse than that. I think they're waiting to exhale, and they don't realize that the longer you hold your breath and the longer you keep from moving forward, that you actually start turning blue. You know, you actually
exactly.
can't breathe. And
exactly.
then it takes a lot longer to recover.
So if you look at, I totally agree, if you look at the concept of innovating, coming up with a new way of doing things or a new prospect for a company, this is the time to do it. And I also contend that in order to keep the job you have, to hang on to your job, When you're working inside a company, you have to be an innovator. And how do you do that? Well, you think like an owner.
Right.
I would love to have a whole bunch of people work for me that were thinking like, what would I do if I owned this company? And each and every person should be walking into their boss's office. This takes great courage and say, listen, I've been looking at this operation. I've been looking at the way my job is being done. I have a thought, an idea of a new way to do it. Can I run it by you? Now, if I am looking at my workforce and I have to let people go, I can assure you as a manager, as a boss, that's not the person that I'm going to let go. I'm not going to let anyone go who comes in with full energy and full enthusiasm with a new way of doing things, who is showing me creativity and innovation and trying to think about what they would do if they owned the company. Every single person should be thinking about what would they do, mm-hmm. how would they handle it if they owned the company. If you can't come up with a new way of doing things, you're not going to survive. Right. Not only is the company not going to survive, but you're going to have a hard time hanging on to your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, even for people who are out looking for jobs, and I volunteer in an organization here in Tampa called Real Estate Lives that's helping people in the construction and real estate industries find new roles in new kinds of companies. And, you know, these folks, many of them have been in that industry their whole lives. And I said to one guy yesterday who happens to be in finance, and then another one who has been, you know, kind of in sales and marketing of you know, new developments, I said, you know, why don't you sit down before your interview and come up with 100 different ideas? They can be crazy.
Great.
They can require
mm-hmm.
money. They can
mm-hmm.
require people. Absolutely no constraints. And come up with 100 ways to help the company that you're interviewing with grow. And then tell the person that you came up with this list of 100 and that you'd like to share the top three with them. And I guarantee you, you will pique their interest. Same kind of thing.
I totally agree. The other thing that people say to me is, this is not a good time. There's no money out there. This is not a good time to start a company. This is not a good time to take that, to be entrepreneurial. And that's not true. When we look back in history, in the history of business, and we look at the companies that started during down times, it's an amazing list. Hewlett-Packard started in 1939, which was really an awful time. Microsoft in 1974. Cisco in 1984. And then after 9/11, I was looking back at that. That's when Vonage started and all those mm-hmm. wonderful companies. So crises, and particularly financial crises or this kind of downturn, may very well be a perfect time to start something new.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article about investors in venture capitalists and looking at concepts, and someone was quoted saying, if someone brings me a thought or concept now, I know it's serious, it's well thought out, it's not at all frivolous, and I would be more inclined to lend money now to this person than in the days where I was flooded with ideas of companies that never had a possibility.
That really makes a lot of sense.
So this is a time when, whether you are working inside a company or whether you are thinking about starting something yourself, when innovation is going to help you survive, but it takes courage and it takes creativity to raise your hand. We're really talking about theoretically raising your hand in this environment. It's so scary. People are, as you mentioned before, they're paralyzed. They're concerned every day, and you can't blame them. We're being bombarded. Our lives are so impacted everywhere by what's going on. But you have to think about, how would I do my job differently?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of company can survive? I mean, think about it. I was talking with one of my coaching clients. We were talking about, she wanted to start a business on the side because she wasn't really sure how long her job was going to survive. And I said, think about the environment. Think about what's going on in the world and how can you tap into that. if you can find a way to help people, individual people, save money, keep more of their money, that's a pretty good idea. If you can help people reposition themselves, if you can help them reimagine themselves, that's a great business these days.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had someone on last week on the transition show, and we were talking a lot about reinvention. We had one woman who had been part of the dot-com bomb and ended up going on vacation to Costa Rica and realized that she had this incredible passion for surfing. And now she runs this company that does surfing training primarily for women and does these surfing camps. You know, a little bit like the Outward Bound experience of giving women confidence that they can try something new. And she didn't learn how to surf until she was 30, I think 32. You know, that kind of encouragement of people just hearing stories and then starting to think about, you know, what they could do. And I talked to another woman who has written a book about her adventures of leaving behind her life in Austin, Texas, and at, you know, age 60, just picking up and moving to New York City, something she'd always wanted to do. And, you know, she was fortunate to be a coach and an author and had some, you know, revenue streams so that she wasn't, you know, kind of going out, you know, totally blind. But it was just really exciting to me to hear how people have envisioned themselves, and I think that you then begin to be able to break out of that. Let me just remind those people who are listening online that if you have any questions, you can initiate a chat session on the homepage of the Solutions Live show. There's a little button called chat, and if you will ask your questions of Nancy, I'll be happy to relay that on to her. And if you do want to call in and ask a question live, that number is 646-727-2840. And I'd also like to put in a little plug for our sponsor today. Speaking of innovation, Greg Fralick has launched another new company. He's got one called Magnetic Messenger, which allows you to print all kinds of great things that you want to send to people that you really want them to put on their refrigerator. But he's got another company called TrendyPrints.com, and I thank Greg for sponsoring us today. All right, Nancy, let's talk about the different kinds of innovation because, you know, I know from my background, I tend to think of innovation as technology, but you've described a lot of different kinds of innovation. So, you know, reinvention is one. New business models, I mean, in my industry, oh, my God, we are so in need of a new business model. And Chris and I are going to talk about that a little bit at 11 o'clock when we talk about innovation and investment in the travel industry. But what kinds of innovation have you been thinking about?
Well, I think you can complicate the issue, and you don't have to. When you talk about the word innovation, you sort of think about, you know, somebody in a garage deciding a new technology, Hewlett-Packard, for example. But that's not necessarily what we should be talking about now. Innovation may be simply a new way of doing the job that you're now doing. I mean, many people are not in a position where they can start their own company. Many people are not in a position where they can leave the security and the comfort of the corporate life. So when you say innovation to those people, somehow their eyes glaze over because they don't have the time, they think, or they don't have the energy, or they don't have the courage. They're just trying to, as I said before, hunkering down to get through this. Let's take that word innovation and make it much less complicated. And it really can be simply walking in tomorrow morning and looking around at the company where you're sitting down at that desk, in that office, and saying, how can I find a different, more efficient, more effective way of doing what I'm now doing? Whether you're a CEO or you're entry level, that's what you need to be thinking about every moment that you're in there. That's innovation. Mm-hmm. You don't have to come up with a new product. You don't have to come up with a new technology. You have to open your mind, and hopefully, and we'll talk about this later, you're in an environment that you can express the ideas, and you can walk into your boss's office and say, "Hey, listen, I have an idea, and let me run this by you." If you have that environment, you need to have the courage to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I think that's really important, Nancy, and the point about people's eyes glazing over when they think that they have to actually carry out whatever it is, you know, that they've got as that new idea, and that they have to do it somehow alone, is really a misconception.
I think we need to take the sort of mystique out of the concept of innovation, and we have to say it's really looking at everything with a different eye, and that's not easy. We all hate change, and we get very comfortable, and we're frightened these days. So I contend that you need to put yourself in a situation where you're not frightened. And one of the ways you can do that, and I hope everyone thinks about this, is you need to have a survival fund. You can't be creative and innovative unless you have some confidence and some courage. And the best possible way to get courage and confidence, no matter what you're doing, is have money put away. And that's what I call a survival fund. And every day, and it doesn't have to be, you don't have to put $1,000 away every week or every month. Who can do that? You need to, starting today, this minute, you need to take $50, $100, and put that money away.
Right, right. You know, it's funny. I was reading over the weekend, I was reading early on in the book of Exodus, where it talks about that, you know, the Pharaoh knew that there was a famine that was about to happen, and because Joseph had interpreted his dream, and he told him very, very practically to start putting away 20% during the 7 good years that were just about to happen, and that after that, there were going to be 7 really horrible years. Now, I mean, that is like the earliest economic cycle on record.
That's the first Susie Orman, right?
Yeah, no kidding. But, you know, I thought about that, and I thought, you know, that is such a practical thing, because whether you make $20,000 a year, $100,000, or $1 million a year, if you can just settle on a percentage that you're going to tuck away into that fund, and, you know, whether you call it a rainy day fund or, you know, I mean, whatever it is, or for someone like me, you know, my innovation fund that allows me to move forward on all of the new ideas that I have.
Great.
You know, I think, you know, and again, 20% sounds like a huge number, especially when you can't make your day-to-day bills. But I think your point of you got to start today.
I agree.
Don't lament the fact that you haven't done it up till now. Start today.
Exactly. Because I think a lot of us had 7 good years and we didn't put the money away.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us spent it, assuming that it would go on forever, and it didn't. And it abruptly stopped for many of us. So I really, if there's one solid piece of advice that I give my coaching clients and everyone I talk to, it's put a little bit of money away. Because I contend that if you don't have that fund, if you don't have that survival fund, a certain amount of money that you can live on, you're not going to have the courage and confidence to raise that hand we talked about.
I agree.
Go into your manager and say, "Let's try something new." So it's very complex, but if I'm advising you, this is the way to hang on to your job by coming up with new ideas and being innovative, and you don't have a way to survive if it all ends tomorrow, you're not going to have the courage to go in with that new idea. It's just this circle. And the other thing that I think is so important in this environment that will give you more courage also is to broaden the concept of what you're going to do next and what you're learning every day, and that's working on your marketability. I don't think that you can be a true innovator unless you have kind of flexed your creative muscles in a lot of different areas. The old world of stepping on the corporate ladder or stepping on a career ladder and going up one step at a time is really over. And I think that's so healthy. The ladder is like a lattice now. It's not a ladder. And I think that you should look at what would I do if I needed to find another job in this company tomorrow? Oh, there's one possibility over in the next division or department. And if you look at it, you have to look at, will I learn something new? Will I grow in any way? Can I afford to do it? How's the money? And then add to your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be always thinking about adding to your portfolio. We never thought about it that way. I never thought about it. I was like straight line. And so many people are that way. In today's environment and world, if we're asking you to be creative, we're asking you, you have no idea where you're going to end up a year from now.
Right.
You have
6 months from now.
Right. And you have no idea what kind of...
Oh, Nancy, you cut out. I am not hearing you. Do you want to pop off and call back in?
Pardon?
You cut out there for a minute.
No, somebody came in, and that's fine.
Okay. So
think about when you're looking at, let's look at the money side and let's look at the talent skill side. These are survival techniques that everybody should be thinking about, because I realize that that there are people that when I say to them, I want you to come up with a new creative, innovative idea, look at me like, hey, I'm just trying to get through the day.
Right.
And so the way that you can get through the day is just to sort of parse out your world a piece at a time. And one is to get that money put away.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is to learn and grow and be creative and add to your skill sets in any way you can.
Mm-hmm. At this meeting I was at yesterday, I must have heard the word transferable skills about 10 times.
There you go.
And what they were talking about were the two dimensions that you just talked about, and then also the geographic dimension, because you've got a whole bunch of people in this particular case, real estate and building, here in the Florida area that can't find work. But right now, apparently, there is just a building boom up in Vancouver getting ready for the Olympics they're going to be hosting. And they said, you know, if you're willing to, buy four tickets a quarter for your spouse or, you know, someone to come up and visit you while you're working up there, you know, there's plenty of work. So you need to be innovative, you know, in that part of your reinvention too. Or, you know, are you at a place in your family life and your relationships where you could go and teach English in Southeast Asia, right now? Or, you know, again, there are lots of places where there is work. And so both from the transition side and from when you're in a company, and whether it's a corporation or a smaller, more entrepreneurial business, I think innovation, it just has to take so many different shapes. But it isn't a luxury. It is survival.
That's right. And the word that you just used, which is transferable, think about that. Think about transferable skills. I do a lot of coaching with some people where I say, okay, sit down and tell me what you like, what you learned, what you could do, what you'd like to do, where you can move, tell me what you do every day. All of those kinds of things. See, we get into a very narrow kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We can no longer have narrow thinking.
Right.
If people need to be innovative with their own career too, never mind with starting new companies. But there's a company too that you've just invented, one that's springing up everywhere. Showing people how they transfer their skills.
Right.
That's
Absolutely.
Another small business that's starting up right now.
Now, tell me a little bit about the Guru Nation and what you do. I know your coaching business tends to focus on coaching, you know, senior executives. How about the Guru Nation?
Well, the Guru Nation is started by my co-author, Amy Copeland, a year ago. And what she is putting together is the most amazing group of coaches, online coaches. It packaged it together in a way in which, and it is, it's free. All you have to do is sign up, and you get to just what we're doing here. But she has, I think she has now certainly well over 100 coaches, all kinds of amazing skills.
Wow.
We do phone-ins. You can talk to them. You can reach out. It's an ongoing coaching, online coaching business. It's just fascinating. So if anyone wants to check in, thegurunation.com, and it is exactly what we're what it says. It's a whole group of gurus that are at your disposal.
Very cool. Why don't you do an electronic introduction for me to Amy, and maybe I can get her to come on the show and talk a little bit about what inspired her to do that.
I would be happy. She's the most entrepreneurial person I know.
That's great. Well, tomorrow's shows are all about the social side and the entrepreneurial side and the spiritual side of life. So if she happens to be available, I would love to snag her, but we can certainly talk about getting her on at some point in time. Well, I'd like to shift focus now a little bit to leadership, because whether you are in a corporation or in an entrepreneurial firm, or you're already out on your own, or you're in transition, you know, the issue of leadership is another real cornerstone of how we're going to get through this mess that we're in right now.
Without question. I can't remember a time that has been more difficult to lead other people, to manage. And when you think about how do you lead in times of turmoil, I think about what my clients are faced with. Money is drying up and the markets are changing. Their market's changing. More important, the morale that they're dealing with is just about at the all-time low. Their workforce is just paralyzed. They often have, and I think this is almost the hardest, they have unreasonable pressure from above for sales and profit. They have to work in an environment that they're cutting back all the time. They need to figure ways to work on the morale of the people that work for them, get them to move forward. They have to set an environment, and this is even more important. We just came out of a conversation on innovation, and one of the pieces of advice that we gave people to hang on to their job was to be able to walk into their boss's office and say, I have a great idea. Let me tell you about it. Now, if you're not the kind of leader that has set an environment of comfort that person can come in and do that works for you, everybody's going to fail.
Right.
So I can't imagine a tougher time. I can't imagine a difficult time for people to lead other people. So let's figure out how they can do that in this world, because no one is going to survive this if they can't figure out how to handle this.
Let's
look at some things that have to be done. I think they have to find a way to deal with the morale and anxiety issue of the people that work for them. It could not be more important to first recognize that and lead in a different way. And by that, I mean to have more compassion and understanding. You have no idea what your staff's going home to at the end of the day, whether or not they're another breadwinner in the family has lost their job. So I believe that you need to be more compassionate and also more honest. This is the hard one.
Right.
People are the anxiety level of the people that you lead, that you're leading today, is just off the chart. You have to be as honest with them as you can be. Now, having been in that situation myself many times, there are certain things that you can't discuss with your staff, and I appreciate that, but there are things that you can. And if you can, let them know that you are human, but that you're in control and in charge, and be as honest with them as you can be about what is going on. The unknowing is what breeds anxiety. And you have to, I was talking to someone the other day about going in every morning with an attitude of optimism. I can't think of anything more important than going in with an attitude of enthusiasm and optimism. And if you're the boss, if you're the leader, and you're tiptoeing around in fear, your entire staff will be useless to you. And don't allow any that whole group of people that work for you to fall into that sort of downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing will get done.
Right. So, well, I would say, though, that, you know, you have to very carefully tie together that optimism and compassion, because, you know, it's easy for someone who's still pulling in a hefty six-figure salary to be optimistic. Last week I had a woman named Michelle Bearsall on my show on Thursday, and she was talking about weathering the financial storm while you're in transition and what it feels like to walk into Target and to look around and think that everything's too expensive right now. And first of all, a lot of senior executives have never, you know, crossed the threshold of Target or Walmart, you know, let alone.
Oh, I bet they are now.
Well, yeah, I bet they are now too, and certainly Target hopes they are. But, you know, and my husband and I were, you know, driving down the street the other day, and he saw, you know, an African-American walking down the street, and he said, oh, look, the Afro's coming back. And I said, Michael, I'm not sure that that's a style thing. But, you know, I mean, I know myself, you know, when I look at cutting back, I cut back on getting my hair done, you know, every couple of weeks. And all of a sudden, you know, I've gotten reacquainted with L'Oreal hair color.
Well, let's look at those six-figure people that we're talking about, because I think we can in many ways demonize them, and we shouldn't, because if they're managing an operation, they are they have to be enthusiastic and energetic, or they will not be managing tomorrow. And there's nothing worse. I sometimes talk with leaders to tell them that they have no idea how important their behavior is.
Right. And Nan, you're cutting out a little bit again.
They have no idea how much their behavior and attitude impacts the staff.
Definitely.
So whether people are making a six figures or five figures, this is a very, very complicated time. How do you keep the morale up of the people that work for you when you can't give them more money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an interesting concept that people need to be rewarded. And the number one way to reward them is recognition. I remember giving out plaques, believe it or not, in a very tough time at CBS when we couldn't reward people with extra money or bonuses or any of those things. And coming up with them, it sounds so simple, but it was a plaque of the Salesman of the Week or Salesman of the Year. But the public recognition of that, the public recognition of that mattered so much to the people that work for me. So
that is really important.
You can't give the bonus. You can't give, mm-hmm. but you have to recognize someone bringing a new idea. You have to recognize someone doing outstanding work. You have to. You can't stop doing that.
Right. One of my guests last week talked about how, you know, over the years they had never once saved a pay stub of a bonus check, but they had a handwritten note
from
one of their bosses 15 years ago telling them that they did a good job. And so, you know, I think even if you can't afford the plaque route, which isn't very expensive, you know, taking the time to write a personal note to someone who isn't even sure that you know their name.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
I had a boss back at American Airlines, Sabre, back in the 80s, and I'll never forget it because it was 1984. I was working on a program for the Olympics in Los Angeles, and the guy who ran the company at the time was Mike Buckman, and he's an amazing communicator, and he walked past my cubicle, and he said, hey, Chickie, how are things going with the Olympics? And again, he was the CEO, I was an analyst, and I had never been personally introduced to him. Now, I'm quite certain that he was just clever enough to glance at my name badge on my cubicle and to see something in my office that brought that to his mind. But I've never forgotten that, and I've told that story dozens of times. So I think that, you know, that kind of thing can go a long way. I want to switch gears here just for a second because we have a question from one of our guests. And hi, Kathy Peterson. Thank you so much for joining. She is going to be my guest on the Executive Girlfriends Group this Friday, and I thank her for listening in. But she has a question for you, Nancy, of what are your thoughts on giving back to the community as a business owner and a leader and how that can redirect the attentions of your employees, perhaps off themselves onto people who are less fortunate?
Wow. It's a great question because this is a time at which that all begins to dry up. And people say, I'm surviving myself and I'm working on keeping myself alive. I can't reach out to other people. I can't give extra time. I can't. And think about it a couple of different ways. If you are reaching out into the community and you are helping other people, you're building your network of contacts. Not only are you probably building your skill set, and I'm being very practical about this, by the way, because you may take on a role in a nonprofit operation outside your company that may add to who you are as an executive, as a manager, you may be handling more things than you've ever handled inside a profit company. And the other thing is that people see you in a different light. One of the pieces of advice that I can give people is here you are working inside a company and you have an opportunity to join a nonprofit for a period of time and you're running a meeting. You've never run a meeting inside your company, and someone sees you in that role. You're building your contacts. You're building your network, which could not be more important. You're working on that lattice that I talked about, which is adding to your skill set. And also, you're keeping your morale and your energy and your enthusiasm up. You are reaching out to other people. You know, we have a tendency in this environment to think, woe is me. How am I going to get through the day? And somehow or other, volunteering and reaching out will help you with that in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that actually came up yesterday at the Real Estate Lives meeting here, that actually volunteering during the time that you're in transition is something that you can put on your resume. And it can help, fill that gap that could otherwise be really glaring. Kathy has one other question, which I think is pertinent, and just to give you a little bit of background, Kathy is the co-host of Lifetime TV series, The Balancing Act,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things I love about her and why I asked her to be on the Executive Girlfriends Group call this Friday is she took a skill that she has, and if you haven't ever seen the show, she is an amazing designer and is really adept at crafts and very, very creative. And she took that skill and she translated that into a project of helping two former foster children who aged out of foster care to remake their five-room duplex. And so she took her time, taught these girls how to make over this home, sewing, decorating, painting, making art. So, you know, it isn't always about just giving money. It's giving of your time and your talents and your treasures. And Kathy has a question. If you have any advice on obtaining corporate sponsorships, on building a speaking tour to inspire others to give back, you know, how can you find those companies who have a particular soft spot for giving back at this particular time? And I'm sure that there are others who are listening who would have the same question.
The question is, how do you find companies that in this environment are still contributing?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's a tough question. I'm sure that there have to be ways of reaching, whether it be a website or somehow or other, that lets you know. If it's a publicly traded company, they're going to let you know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, I don't have any hands-on knowledge of companies that are still contributing, but you know, I'm sure they're out there.
There's a new business idea in there somewhere.
There certainly is matching up, right?
I'm going to work on that.
Matching up, matching people that want to give on maybe a smaller level.
Right.
You know, maybe people that have companies that have been writing checks for years that have decided they can no longer afford to do that but want to find a way to connect their employees with outside companies.
Absolutely. Well, that is actually something I'm going to noodle on.
You know, I volunteer.
I haven't created a new business for a couple of weeks now.
Right. I think the whole thought of volunteering in order to expand who you are and what you've learned and what you can do is an amazing idea. And instead of people who are, shall we say, between jobs or transitioning, spending an enormous amount of time trying to get another job. And I recognize that people, if they don't have that survival fund that I want them all to have, need very much to fill the coffers back up. But I am telling you that there's another coffer that needs to be filled up, and that is someplace to go where you matter.
Right.
I started volunteering for Dress for Success, which is a marvelous organization.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you to share that. I'm glad you jumped in with that.
Which is a marvelous organization, which gets women ready for interview ready for work, disadvantaged women. And I started volunteering on Monday mornings because when my CBS career was over, the morning that I had the hardest time with was Monday morning. So I thought in order for me to emotionally survive, I'm going to need to have a place to go on Monday morning where I matter and where I'm making a difference. And that was 10 years ago when I started volunteering for Dress for Success, and I'm still doing it.
Very interesting. You know, I had reached out to them here in Tampa as well because I was trying to set up a charity that my daughter could volunteer her time. And my daughter is 10 and just has a real passion for giving. So I set up a local charity here called Kids for Humanity. And I thought, you know, kids may not be able to donate their time to a lot of things, but, you know, I know my daughter could go around to every house in the neighborhood and ask if women had suits that they no longer wore or didn't fit or whatever it was.
Right.
And that, you know, she could get her friends to do that in all of their neighborhoods. So, you know, that brings up a good point back to the leadership point and back to the point of a leader being able to make themselves more human, looking to their people. Because again, if you've got this aura of the corner office and you know, still driving, you know, the Mercedes or the BMW, even though, you know, it may have been paid off years ago and you know, it isn't really an economic statement just as much as having a car that, you know, is durable and works well. But, you know, to the person who is struggling and whose spouse just lost their job, you know, I think that if leaders can show what they're doing in the community, and I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about going out and building a house for Habitat for Humanity or doing something highly visible and giving the employees a way to participate in that, of giving of their time when perhaps they used to be able to give money, whether it was to their church or to their local charity. You brought up in an email to me yesterday that, you know, this time is not only tough, you know, for those of us who are dealing with employment issues, but those of us who did make a significant salary in the past and perhaps don't have the same income level, you know, I mean, my husband and I used to be prolific givers. And, I mean, we still are, but we're giving proportionately to what we make. And, you know, I can't wait for the day when I can afford, you know, to stock my trunk with food for the homeless, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And you know, so the people who don't have funds and don't have the wherewithal to get a job, like the women who participate in Dress for Success, you know, I think if leaders can step up and be visible in their community, now is the time to do that. And, you know, that may be counterintuitive, but I think it really is the time.
Let me tell you another reason why that's important. When I talk with the leaders that I coach and I recognize what kind of pressure they're in, and, you know, as I said, it's sometimes very easy to demonize the person in the corner office, but I can assure you from my experience that the stress and the pressure that they're dealing with now is, for me, unparalleled than I've ever seen. And one of the things that I counsel my clients as a business therapist is to say, you need to find ways to deal with your personal stress. You will be of no good to anyone that works for you if you cannot begin to find ways, new ways to deal with your personal stress. Whether and one of the best ways to deal with personal stress is to reach out and perhaps volunteer on every other Saturday or something, because you need to take care of yourself first. You can't take care of anyone else. You
right.
you cannot lead other people if you're paralyzed. You just can't. You can't create an environment where people will bring you the creative ideas that will allow your company to survive if you are filled with anxiety and hiding in your office because you're terrified of the latest quarterly numbers that are not going to make the goal. So it is really, really, really complicated being a leader today.
Mm-hmm.
You are leading other people when you are under the most unbelievable stress yourself. So if you can't find ways to deal with your personal stress, you're not going to be an effective leader or manager in any way.
Right. Nancy, what are the top three specific things that leaders are asking you to help them with right now?
Well, the number one thing is what do I do with the morale on my staff?
Right.
My staff seems paralyzed. I can't get them. They're filled with anxiety. I'm catching all these conversations tucked in corners. I can only share with them so much information about how healthy or unhealthy the company is. There's some information that I can't share. What is your advice on how I can help with this morale issue on my staff? The other problem that they're dealing with is I need to find ways to convince the people that work for me that any changes we make now are not temporary, they're permanent. That sounds easy, but it's not, because we hate change, and we all want to think, okay, we're going to do it this way now, but 6 months from now, it will all go back to the way it was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Leaders need to focus everyone forward and have their staff recognize that it is not temporary. These are not temporary changes. These are not temporary things. These are permanent things. So handling other people. And then the other thing is just what I said. I look at some of my clients and I can see fear in their eyes and I say, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you working out? What are you doing? What are you doing to deal with your own personal stress? You just spent an hour with me telling me all the things that are happening as you have unreasonable profit and sales goals that you know you're not going to make. You have a staff that's paralyzed. You have a husband that perhaps is out of work. What are you doing so that you stay sane and healthy?
Right.
The whole house of cards will fall if you don't stay sane and healthy. So those are really the three things that I'm dealing with now. Managers and leaders who are caught in this absolute
right.
tsunami, and they really want to help the people that work for them. They really do. First of all, it's very practical, but also they're very decent people, and they recognize that everybody is that these are a really unusual time. So getting them to move to think forward and not always looking back.
Right.
Getting them to recognize the changes are permanent, not temporary. Finding ways to reward performance when you don't have money, you can't give raises. And also taking care of their personal stress issues.
That's really great. And you know, when I think back to the first half hour of this show, it really points out to me that innovation is the answer. Innovation in rewards and recognition. Innovation in making sure that those changes that you're making that are permanent are as painless as possible. And I don't mean just helping people deal with change, but actually to put processes and procedures in place that are appropriate to the current staffing levels and to the goals. Because you can't, you know, I mean, a board can't come in, and they do it every day, by the way, and put those high sales goals in place and at the same time approve you cutting, you know, 80% of your sales force.
That's exactly what's going on.
I know. It's mind-boggling. And I think that what they don't do is to draw those concentric circles that looks like a target and put the customer in the middle. And
well, they're trying to survive, too.
But again, putting the customer in the middle and truly understanding who serves your customer and generates revenue and those processes and procedures that you've had in place for a zillion years that don't make sense anymore and that don't serve the customer and don't serve the person who's serving the customer or the person who's helping the person who serves the customer. So I think customer centricity is really an important kind of innovation, and employee centricity, which is what you just talked about, of realizing that the only way to combat the total lack of morale that we have and the demoralization that has gone on from watching your friends lose their job or watching the talented in your organization lose their job and to keep the marginal people because they didn't make much or they're
younger, or
whatever reasons. And you and I have talked a lot about that.
By the way, that's actually not really happening. I was so encouraged to see a recent article, maybe Portfolio Magazine, that talked about companies have, not all of them, unfortunately, but many of them have woken up to the thought that they need that middle manager, that person that's been there for a while.
Right.
No matter, they need them to keep this company moving forward. That we're finding more and more cases where companies are not letting those people go.
That's encouraging. And now I can tell you that, you know, my personal experience, particularly within the small microcosm of my executive girlfriends group, which is about 140 senior executive women in the travel industry, you know, we're still seeing the cuts happening, you know, and I won't say willy-nilly because I know that there's been a lot of thought and a lot of money spent with, you know, the Bains and McKenzies of this world to try to do a rational, responsible job, you know, but still, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
Right. Well, I was very encouraged by that because the thought that companies are going to end up with senior executives stuck in corner offices and a whole bunch of entry-level people and no one in the middle that knows what they're doing is really dreadful to think about.
Right. Yeah, it is. It is. And that in and of itself is part of the demoralization. And that if people believe that all that's left behind are the people who aren't going to be capable, then it's even more demoralizing for the people who are still there, who are the really, really hard workers, the people with the, you know,
knowledge,
knowledge is really important in company history, which you had mentioned to me in one of our other dialogues. But also the people who have the, you know, 50-hour work week ethic. And again, I'm not going to argue whether that's a good thing or not. But, you know, if you've got people who are out of there at, you know, 5:01 and you used to, you know, be able to say to somebody over a weekend, oh, hey, I need this project done by Monday. And they say, no problem. And now you hear, sorry, dude, you know, off to the beach.
Let me loop back and sum up here, Chickie.
Okay.
We need innovators.
Mm-hmm.
To keep moving forward, people need to think about their work like their owners, and they need to come in with new creative concepts that they can do their business, their job, their work in a new, efficient, entrepreneurial way. We also, in addition, need leaders who will set an environment that people are comfortable coming in and saying, let's try a different way. We need the combination of innovation, and we need the combination of leaders that allow innovation to just blossom. Hard thing to do, to get both of those things going.
Right.
That is
really excellent advice, though, Nancy.
Great.
I think, you know, hopefully, again, whether the folks who are listening to this show, both live today and those that listen to it and download it as the weeks go by, that they will think about this, you know, in their own personal situation, those who are leaders, will think about how to motivate their own people and how to communicate the changes that are happening and you know, to really deal with their personal stress. And
exactly.
You know,
and the last mm-hmm. thing, the personal stress thing, could not be more important. And I see that that's the one that's falling by the wayside, by the way.
Right.
And it gives it concerns me with my clients that they're mm-hmm. not they're not addressing it. Nothing else will work, or nothing else will allow them to lead effectively and courageously if they're not dealing with their own personal stress.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the things I'm trying to combat with the Solutions Live series, because I believe that people need to hear encouragement. They need to hear about innovation and great models of leadership. And on Thursday, our program is all about the personal side of professional life, starting out with talking about life balance and health and wellness and giving as an important component of your personal health, and then also continuing our series on transitions. So, you know, I am excited to be a part of helping folks, and I'm hoping that you will tell your coaching clients about the show so that they can go back and listen not only to this one with you, but to some of the others that may help them address their issues. And I'm gonna be thinking about that, of really gearing some of our programs to, you know, to helping on these particular points,
Great.
Morale and change management and their own personal stress. Well, thank you so much, Nancy, and I look forward to our next conversation.
You're welcome. I loved being with you. Thanks, Chickie.
Okay, great. Terrific. All right, before we move on to our next guest, I want to just thank again our sponsor, TrendyPrints.com. and their sister company, MagneticMessenger.com. For those of you who want to get out some innovative announcements or party invitations or just to share pictures from your latest vacation, check out Magnetic Messenger and TrendyPrints.com. Okay, we are going to shift gears to investment and innovation as it relates to that, and I am going to bring on air my next guest, Chris Dane. Chris, are you on the phone? All right, hang on 1 second. Let me bring you live. Chris.
Well, good morning, Chickie.
Good morning.
Well,
I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. How would you like to begin today?
Well, I want to just kind of set the stage for everybody. As I mentioned in the opening for the show, Chris and I were fortunate enough to be asked by Fox Business several weeks ago to do an on-air interview on the TV show Money for Breakfast. And Chris was live in the studio in New York, and I was at the local Fox studio here in Tampa and ended up just being on the phone due to technical difficulties. But, you know, we enjoyed our time on that show, and we were talking about the rivalry between Carnival Cruise Lines and Royal Caribbean. And, you know, due to the nature of the way that those shows are produced, the segments are actually pretty short by design. And on my way home, I got on the phone with Chris, and I said, you know what, Chris, we could have talked about this for an hour. And he's like, no kidding. And I said, well, why don't we talk about it for a half an hour on my show? So what I would like to do is to just start out, you know, kind of taking a look at the current state of the travel industry and also more specifically of the cruise business. And for those who know the industry well or who are looking at investing in this industry, you'll know that we are right in the middle or perhaps right at the end of something called the wave season. Chris, can you just tell us what the wave season is and what it means to the cruise industry?
Well, historically, what the wave season is when people literally book their vacations for the entire year. And wave season generally starts the second week of January, runs through as late as April 1st for both cruises and tours. And during that time, both cruise lines and tour companies have historically, at least, captured about 70-80% of their business for the year. So it was how the wave season or the vacation season went, so went the whole entire year, if you will. Obviously, a lot has changed in that time, in that people are now booking closer in, you know, because of the uncertainty of their own situation and the economy in general.
Right. And let me just also back up, and I'm going to have you just give a little bit about kind of your recent past. But Chris and I have known each other for well over 20 years. We both worked back for American Airlines in the Sabre organization, which Sabre is the technology that a lot of travel agencies use. It's also the technology behind the Travelocity system and a number of other travel suppliers and technology companies. And Chris, we have kept in touch over the years. We also both participate in a group called the Garrison Lehman Group as their top experts, not only on the travel industry, but we are both fortunate to be part of the kind of the 5% top of their 200,000 experts worldwide. So tell us about what you're doing or what you've been doing over the past few years since your days at Sabre and American Airlines, and why you have become an expert that Garrison Lehman would draw upon.
Well, after I left American, I went to work running Delta Airlines Vacations, which they outsource to a private tour operator. At that time, it was known as the Certified Vacations, which probably was certainly in the top four tour operators in the country, and Delta Vacations was about 90% of their business. After that, I was a founder and an investor in a company called Vacation.com, which was going out and...
I didn't remember that part of your history.
Yep, and so we, you know, I was the one who integrated the acquisitions we made into a single entity. So we bought seven U.S. consortias and one Canadian. And then I left when we sold it to Amadeus,
right.
And certainly what I still do since that time is a consultant. And I kind of got stuck in the consulting business quite by accident when a friend of mine who had invested in this little company asked me to help them try and figure out how to monetize their model. And that little company was called TripAdvisor.com.
Oh, wow.
And so that's how I got started in the consulting business, which I continue to this day. And I also today also work for a company called HRG, Hogg Robinson Group, which is a publicly held company out of the UK that is the third largest travel management company in the world. And by that, I mean they handle the Fortune 1000 companies all over the world, if you will.
Got it. Yeah, a lot of folks in the U.S. Don't know that as a household name yet, but hopefully they will. All right. Well,
yep.
Let's talk about the cruise line business, both in terms of price and volume. And again, the focus here isn't so much on from the consumer perspective, which cruise line should you cruise on. But let's talk a little bit about the industry, and I'll just kind of chime in first. I mean, one of the things that people don't necessarily understand, and those who have not yet invested in the travel industry, don't understand that we are one of the largest industries in the world. And it's funny because as I log on to systems like LinkedIn and Plaxo and different ones that make you pick what industry you're in, it always amazes me that they leave travel off as an industry.
Yes, and if you're lucky, you may find on occasion hospitality or travel and transportation, then they start talking about freight forwarders and those kinds of things.
Right. And, you know, this industry here in the U.S. generates $740 billion a year in direct revenues from the sale of airline tickets, car rental, hotel, cruise, tour, and then all of the ancillary spending that happens in restaurants within resorts and transportation such as Amtrak and bus and the other things that people use. Now, an interesting thing that I generally share with investors as I talk to them is that, you know, you would think that an enormous part of that is sold online, certainly with the advertising and the presence of people like Orbitz and Travelocity and Expedia and Priceline here in the U.S. and then, you know, their counterparts in Europe and Asia. But actually only $137 billion of that $740 billion is sold through online channels. And then only $129 billion is still sold through the travel agency community. Leaving a whole bunch that is just transpiring directly with the suppliers by phone or actually by, you know, just kind of showing up and walking up. And as I think you know, I'm pretty passionate about trying to help the industry grow and to figure out how to tap into the rest of that market. And one of the things I've been focused on is taking a look at how that market is constituted from the people who are flying versus the people who are driving. And, you know, I was personally astounded when I saw that 85% of all Americans drive, yet there hasn't been technology to address that. And, you know, as you and I were talking about the cruise market a couple of weeks ago on the Fox show, you know, it occurred to me that the cruise lines have invested a whole lot of money in building out all of these local ports. Do you see those local ports as something that has been key to their growth strategy? And if so, you know, why have they still focused primarily on attracting the airline traveler to those ports by having the air-sea packages as their primary offering?
Well, you know, clearly that has been the mainstay for their growth, has been, you know, closer in ports where you can, you know, drive to ports, if you will, or bringing the cruise product closer to more Americans. And part of the reason for that is what makes the cruise industry an appealing business, if you will, a business model over the long term. I don't know if there's anything that's appealing in the short term these days in any industry, but what makes it appealing over the long term is that, you know, only 17 or less than 17% of Americans have ever been on a cruise. And
wow.
So it has a very low penetration rate. And therefore, by bringing the cruise ports, if you will, closer to the population, the coastal population in particular, to your point, it helps to address that 85% of the population that's driving. And, of course, you know, what's helped that, of course, has been the hassle factor, if you will, in flying in terms of the whole less than exciting airport experience.
Yeah, that is absolutely on target. When I was doing my research for the Fox show, one of the things that occurred to me, and I love to cruise. My husband and I have always been frequent cruisers. And you're now seeing Carnival, who certainly is the largest firm in the industry, coming out with seven-night packages for $299. And I don't know about you, but that sounds to me like cruising is now cheaper than staying home.
Well, you know, and it's funny, I heard on the radio this morning on one of the business channels that there was a cruise company, although they didn't identify who it was, who you could take a two-week cruise with an outside cabin for $7.99 a person.
Wow.
And, you know, so that's, you know, $1,500, $1,600. You have I'm not so sure you could live at home as well, and certainly can't do as many of the things as you could on a two-week cruise. The second part of it is that while it is truly a great value, you even see cruise lines like Seabourn, who's at the, you know, the absolute luxury end, top end of the cruise business, you know, discounting as much as 50%, which is, you
right.
don't normally see luxury cruise lines discounting to that extent.
I hope my husband is listening to this show, because Seabourn is actually our absolute favorite experience. Let's talk a little bit about the rivalry between Carnival and RCL and how those two companies have evolved. And, you know, out of the fleet of ships for the cruise line industry, and these are the primary cruise lines in the world, there are 159 total ships right now, and 88 of those are Carnival and all of the different Carnival brands. So that's 55% of the fleet, and 39 are RCL, which is just 24%. Chris, do you have the sense that represents what their actual market share is?
Well, their market share, if you took all of the Carnival Corporation brands, which is, I hope I can remember them all, Carnival Cruise Lines, Princess, of course, Holland America, Cunard, Seabourn, and Costa. They represent
P&O. They have P&O, Ocean Village, and Ada.
Yes, yes, I forgot Ada, of course. Their European cruise brand. And if you look at, you know, Carnival Corp, the two of them control about 80% of the cruise business in the U.S. and probably a little better than 70% in the world. And obviously Carnival has the lion's share of that, Royal Caribbean has about 31 of that 80, so Carnival obviously has the rest. And so when you say that RCI has 24% of the ships and 31% of the capacity, I think that goes to the heart of the fact that they have generally larger ships, which allows them to take a bigger piece of the market share. And while they are still very much rivals, you know, they seem to take a slightly different approach to going after customers. Carnival certainly is the fun ships. That's how they started. They're really into multi-generational trips. Royal Caribbean is more into, you know, bigger ships, more activity-based, although you can do nothing on the Royal Caribbean. They seem to want to go after a slightly younger crowd, a slightly younger, more affluent crowd than Carnival. But they're both clearly mass marketer kind of cruise lines.
Yeah, I actually heard recently that Royal Caribbean took a whole group of baby boomer women, and they took them on a four-month tour of all of their ships. And they did that so that they could get their input on what the ships needed to look like in the future. And, you know, those women came back and not surprisingly said, you know, you need more storage, you need adjacent cabins, and, you know, the ability to open a door between cabins. And I will absolutely second that, because we used to have a nanny when our kids were younger, and, you know, it was great to go on a cruise with the family, and the nanny would sleep with the two kids, and my husband and I would get our own cabin. And now that our kids are older, you know, we don't need the nanny, but, you know, the thought of going on a cruise and having the kids in the cabin with us for a week, you know, is you know, not something I would like to do, but I would be happy to have adjacent cabins. So, you know, that resonates with me. And, I mean, silly things like footrests in the shower so that you can shave your legs when you're on the cruise without being tossed around and, you know.
Yes, that's not a problem for me.
Yeah, that's not a problem for me,
as you might imagine.
But, you know, as you take a look at what these guys are doing moving forward, and you know, I mean, these ships are very, very large. And the new Oasis of the Sea that RCL is coming out with, I think in December of 2009, you know, it's got 2,700 cabins. And they've actually split the ship into seven neighborhoods. And, you know, why in the world, you know, would you continue increasing capacity like that? Or was this something that the decisions were just made in better times and, you know, it's just too late to reverse them?
Well, the cruise industry, because of the low penetration rate, has historically been build it and they will come. And that is even, you know, even in these, you know, terrible economic times, the good news is they are still carrying, you know, they're keeping up with the growth in terms of passengers that they're carrying. So they're still operating. Their load factor, if you will, is generally over 100, and they view it as something more than two people in a room. So if you had two people in all of their cabins in the quarter, it would be 100%. And they're typically running a 101 to 103%. And they continue to do that today, even in these times, but they're doing it on price, you know, to get the volume.
Right,
and
so there is a lot of discounting going on.
A ton, just a ton. And I mean,
so why is that good business to do that?
Well, two, it introduces, you know, only about 50% of cruisers are repeat cruisers. So there is a high propensity for first time, and you'd expect that with such a low penetration rate. And so what you're finding is that the people do want to get away. They're siding closer in. You know, once they get over the psychological aspects of, I can't get away, I'll lose my job, or I can't leave because my colleagues are being laid off and I feel terrible about doing it. Once they get through that, they're discounting the price to fill up the ships, and at the same time, they're building a future market. Now, I don't think there's any question they'll make money, even with the lower yield, and I think, you know, the yield will stay this way for the most part through certainly the early part of May. And as demand picks up, obviously the vacation demand peaks in the summertime, prices will rise. They still may be down on a year-over-year basis, but they will certainly rise. And so if you were going to think about doing the cruise and you wanted the best value, you know, this would be the time to do it before that May period. Or you can hold off till till after the summertime, if you will.
Chris, as you take a look at the cruise lines that are publicly traded, and we've got a few now that have been taken over by private equity companies.
Yep.
what do you see as a difference in behavior? I mean, the normal thing that happens, you know, clearly when private equity companies come in is, you know, the intense focus on cost control. And, you know, there's only so much you can do to cut costs on a cruise line because you do have so many costs that tend to be more fixed costs, you know, high costs of capital, tons of employees. You know, so how are those lines competing, and what's different between the publicly traded companies?
Well, I guess if you look at Carnival, for example, with the various brands, they're able to they have the most buying power when it comes to products and services, for like, for example, food, et cetera, on the ships, towels and the like. So they do probably, as a result of their size, they probably have the lowest cost on a per item that they're buying, because they do manage those things probably better than anybody, and they do it in such a way that it does not impact the customer experience. So,
right.
You know, if you're buying pasta, you can buy it for all the crews, all the ships at once in the various places and take advantage of those economies, because pasta is pasta, whether you're on Seabourn or Carnival. Royal Caribbean, on the other hand, takes a much more technological view because they don't have the size that the Carnival does, so they try to use technology to keep their costs down, you know, because they can't buy as well, but they do buy very well, relatively speaking. And then you get to folks like NCL, to your point, is owned by Apollo Management, 50%, I believe it is. And, you know, that's a company that has historically been in trouble. Has never really done as well as Carnival or Royal Caribbean, and but now they have aligned themselves with a couple of smaller cruise lines that Apollo has also purchased,
mm-hmm.
and so they get to take advantage of some of those things that they couldn't before. But again, they have to, and NCL's claim to fame, if you will, is they've probably been the most innovative of bringing the cruise ships closer to home. They were the first to go. For example, to the Houston market. So they wanted to opened up new markets for cruise ships and brought the ships closer to home so they could avoid, you know, competing directly, if you will, with the with Royal Caribbean and Carnival.
Right.
And then you take NCL, even looking at New York, they operate on a year-round basis. They were the first to operate a year-round basis out of New York, and they do it to the Caribbean. And again, that makes it a unique product for them. And that's how they're trying to survive.
Right. Well, I mean, the guys at Apollo are very, very smart. I worked for them a couple of years ago on a large acquisition project. So, you know, I'm confident that they will, you know, streamline things. You know, these companies typically have a pretty nice cash balance on their balance sheets. You know, in taking a look at Carnival's net profits for 2000, it was $2.4 billion. And, you know, you had Royal Caribbean at $603 million. What are people saying about what the profitability picture is going to look like this year? Are we going to look at it being more flat? Are we actually going to be behind last year? Have you taken a look moving forward?
I think what you're going to see is you're going to be certainly down somewhat significantly on a year-over-year basis. Royal Caribbean is, if you watch their stock price, you know, they have slid the most, if you will. When you start doing the comparisons, you automatically compare Royal Caribbean and Carnival. And so I think the issue is Royal Caribbean is going to have a tougher time than Carnival will this year. Both will be down, all three will be down when you add in NCL. Will be down on a year-over-year basis, really driven on the yield side of the equation.
Right.
As I said earlier, the passengers or the cruisers, if you will, are still showing up because of price. So they're going to do fine there, but yeah, they will not do nearly as well as last year.
Who is the weakest cruise line financially?
Well, I guess you'd probably have to say. You know, in terms of overall that you could address, is probably of any size would probably be NCL. And while I think they will, you know, they will get through this period because of the of Apollo's acquisition of them and Apollo's acquisition of the smaller cruise lines that, that they've also made, I think the combination of those will help get, give benefits to both that neither one enjoy today. So they're probably the weakest. Probably the second weakest is Royal Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in the stock price. And the strongest is obviously Carnival.
Right. Let's talk just a little bit about the fuel price and the fluctuation that we have seen, you know, from the summertime when the cost per barrel was in the $140 range. And I actually haven't checked it in the last week or so, but I know we were hovering down around $40.
And it still is. I just checked it this morning.
Okay, yeah, because it's interesting because, I mean, certainly the price at the gas pump is starting to go up again. We were down as low as, I think we hit just under $1.50 about a month ago, and I noticed yesterday it's $1.78 at the pump. So what is the impact on the cruise lines? Is that their largest cost?
Yes.
Their largest controllable cost? Or I guess it's not controllable because they've got to burn up the fuel whether the ships are full or not.
You know, it's funny because fuel has become a major part of their expense and is indeed the largest part of their expense these days. So, to the extent that they control it, they have slowed down the ships, if you will. They've done a bunch of different things to try and save fuel. Again, you know, one of the things that drives fuel is weight. So to the extent that they could lighten things on a ship, you know, every little thing. And they've gone essentially through all the same things. On a similar scale as the airlines have. The difference being is that the airline product is a commodity, and the cruise product enjoys, you know, a great brand reputation, and
right.
So they do things in such a way as to not impact their perception in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about differentiation for a minute, because you mentioned the airlines, and it's getting harder and harder if you were an airline to differentiate your service. The cruise lines have gone through kind of the same thing that the hospitality industry started going through, I would say, you know, 6 or 8 years ago, which is I would call the battle of the bed. And all of a sudden, we had all of the different, you know, whether it's the Sleep Number bed at Radisson or the different bedding that you have at the Westin. And so I noticed my husband and I went on a Disney cruise last year, and they really tout their bedding now. Is that something you're seeing as a trend?
Well, I think they're going through, you know, if you think of the cruise line as really a floating hotel, they're going through all the same machinations that the hotel industry is in, that converting to flat screen TVs, having bedding wars about redoing the beds, a la the hotels as they bring the ships
amenities
and those kinds of things. So they're absolutely going through that scenario as well.
Chris, do you have any inclination as to how much revenue is actually generated once people are on board versus what they actually pay for the cruise? Several years ago when my firm helped rebuild LasVegas.com, I was pretty astounded when I found out that some of the casinos at that time, you know, the room was actually totally incidental, to their overall revenue stream, and that they wanted to get them on property and not only spending on gaming but in the shops and in the restaurants. What's the picture look like on the cruise line side as we bring this to a close?
Well, the short answer is, I cannot tell you the percentage because it keeps moving around as they add services that they charge for. For example, you know, both Carnival, most of the cruise lines are doing separate dining facilities that have a surcharge to them, which didn't exist several years ago.
Right.
So it is critical, and the point is when they get on the ship, you know, Carnival probably does the best job of marketing on the ship. As a friend of mine in a cruise line says, you know, we take them and shake them upside down till all their money falls out. but those revenues likewise are down on a year-over-year basis as well.
Disney does a pretty good job of that myself.
Yeah, actually they do. They do indeed. But I don't know what the percentage is. But it is significant to the extent that, you know, when you buy your cruise, you know, it's certainly when you go to a land-based vacation, everything is a la carte. When you're on a cruise ship, it is somewhat all-inclusive, except you do have tips you have to leave. You do have your shore excursions.
Right.
And you do have
much help. Unless you go on Seabourn and tipping is optional.
Right, exactly.
And alcohol is included. So.
Exactly. They need to plan for it. But those revenues are certainly down for them, and it is a significant portion of the revenue. I just couldn't tell you the specific percentage.
So if I am an analyst with an investment firm that hasn't invested in the travel industry in the past, and I'm looking at an opportunity, whether it's investing on the equity side or on the debt side of some of these transactions, where you've got a private equity company in place, would you encourage me or discourage me right now?
I would absolutely encourage you if you were dumb enough to invest in the travel industry at all. And the only way you would do it that would make any sense whatsoever would be on the cruise side. It's a great future. It's going through what the rest of the world is going through now. But unlike most of the rest of the world, they will still remain profitable for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And still have a bright future in terms of growth.
Well, great. Well, Chris, I was absolutely right. We could have talked about this for an hour. Our half hour is coming to a close, and I would love to have you back on. I think you and I probably should talk about the online side of the industry and the global distribution side. So I will make sure to get back with you and schedule that.
Well, thank you. Certainly the 30 minutes certainly went by quickly for me as well, but I did appreciate it. And thanks very much, Chickie.
All right, Chris. Take care. All right. On the break, we are just going to talk real quickly about our sponsor, Trendy Prints, and their sister company, Magnetic Messenger. Check out their websites at trendyprints.com and magneticmessenger.com. And now we are going to turn our focus to growth and branding, and give me 1 second to get Libby Gill on the air. Hang on. Libby, you're on the air.
I am here. How are you, Chickie?
I am doing just great. How's the weather out in California?
Oh, we shouldn't torture our friends in the rest of the country, but it's fabulous.
Well, no, we do need to let them know how wonderful it is. And I know here in Florida, we depend an awful lot on tourism. I mean, Chris and I just got finished spending a half an hour talking about cruise lines. And I know that both Carnival and Royal Caribbean, as well as Disney and their other compatriots, would absolutely love to have people come to Florida and enjoy their product.
And cruise out of Los Angeles and Long Beach as well. I do a lot of speaking on cruise ships. So
really?
I do. I'm pretty familiar
cool.
with that world. Mm-hmm.
I need to get that gig. That sounds really great.
It's a lot of fun. I talk about Hollywood, which, of course, is my first career, because they don't want to talk about business as much as something fun. So I do all sorts of things on the history of Hollywood. And I started my career as an actress many years ago. So I do an improv class and acting and improv for adults, which is just great fun, especially when
I somehow missed that in your career background. I picked up on the corporate side.
This is my fun working vacation time. I do. I took my mom to Bermuda. My boyfriend and I went to Barcelona and cruised through Spain and the Canary Islands last year. So that's just a little sideline just for me.
Right, but no, the acting piece I missed.
Oh, the acting piece? Oh, I tell a story about that, about my years studying acting and then my big break on General Hospital, where after all these years studying Shakespeare, my big debut was being the hostess in the restaurant where the doctors hang out, and my big opening line was, "Menu?" And that's about the response I get.
Really well.
And I tell that story. It's like, okay, well, that made sense. I very quickly moved behind the camera and decided I needed a real career. So.
Well, I now have to tell you that I used to have two cats, and one was named Spencer and the other was named Scorpio, and that was from the very early days of General Hospital when Luke and Laura were in vogue. So.
Well, I was just post Luke and Laura. I was in the days of Holly and Scorpio. So they had moved on, but Scorpio was, I know, I'm old, Jiggy.
Those were great cats. I'm sure my cats aren't still around either. Why don't you give us just a little bit of the corporate side of your background and tell us how branding became a passion of yours.
Sure. Well, as you know now, I started on the acting side, and then decided it was time to move behind the camera. And I really sort of fell into my first job because it was a good all around fit for me in terms of people and writing skills and creative the side of me and strategy. And it was working in the public relations department of what was then a mid-sized entertainment company owned by Norman Lear, who was the guy that brought All in the Family and all of those sitcoms for many years. And I started in that company, and it was quickly bought by Coca-Cola, and it was part of Columbia then, and then it was bought by Sony. And in 5 years, I went from being the office assistant to being the vice president of publicity, advertising, and promotion, overseeing five divisions within Sony, and then went from there to Turner Broadcasting, and eventually became the head of corporate communications and public relations at Universal in the Worldwide Television Group. So I spent about 15 years in the corporate side of television, both domestic and international. And what my job was internal communications was a huge part of it, creating corporate culture, and worked very closely with all the division heads. I think at one time I reported to five different different division heads as well as the chairman. So I really had a good handle on what the company was doing and how to communicate that within. But the bigger job was creating that profile and the media profile for the studio itself, the television group, and individual properties, which were talk shows and sitcoms and dramas, and everything from Married with Children to Law and Order to just a whole host of talk shows. I've worked on everything from Ricky Lake to Sally Jesse Raphael to Jerry Springer, Maury Povich to Dr. Phil. So it was a big part of my world was creating the brand message that would cut across the competition and make that property stand out. And of course, when you're launching a property, which to me was the most fun, was launching a project, it's a very different exercise than when you're in year 9 or year 19, as we sometimes were lucky enough to reach with some of our shows. But it was really constantly creating that message and then reinvigorating that to continue to add to the base. And it's really very much like that for executives internally who have to brand themselves. And anybody that thinks that feels, you know, manipulative or clinical, they better get over that. I mean, as you listen, and we talked about this before, as you listen to what's happening in the marketplace, this is not the time to duck and cover. This is the time to create an image, a brand, a reputation for yourself if you're on the corporate side. And on the entrepreneurial side, of course, you must do the same to reach your customers and clients. And
right, and we started off at 10 o'clock talking with Nancy Widman, you know,
who
is also a broadcasting innovator and was also a pioneer in her days with CBS. And, you know, we talked about innovation, and we talked about, you know, how important it is. In fact, it's actually the survival mechanism right now that you have to innovate. And, you know, I think with innovating, you know, comes the natural extension, which is branding. So from your perspective, why is branding especially important right now when it seems like the bottom is falling out and the sky is falling and every other metaphor you can come up with?
Right. Well, you have to get smarter than you've ever had to be before, because it's so critical. Here's how I think of it. You have to capture the minds of your customers and your clients. And once you capture that mind share, then the market share, meaning they open up their wallets, they hire you, they buy your products or services, the mind share leads the way for the market share to follow. And in these times when companies from the Bombay company to Bear Stearns are shutting their doors, it's really important to make some very tough decisions, to get smarter about the way you do your business, so that you, if you have to make cuts, that you cut very carefully, that you, if you're making cost-cutting measures, as a lot of people are, that you don't cut so deeply that you've cut away all the meat from the bones, because you may not be able to recover from that. Your business can really suffer.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you don't make very wise and judicious cuts, you may really be plagued with cash flow problems and not be able to ride out the difficult times. So that's one of the first things you have to do. And often people will look at their marketing and public relations efforts and think, well, you know, that's a cost center. It's not a profit center. So let's get rid of that first. And I think that's short-sighted, and that's a huge mistake. So I do think that cuts are often necessary, but it's cutting the cost, not the marketing. So looking for low-cost options, whether those are social networking or digital tools or the way you do business or cutting your overhead, and looking for different ways to do what you need to do. I mean, there are so many great tools that didn't exist just a few years ago. I mean, there are online services like Help a Reporter Out, where you can get 3 emails a day that will tell you media opportunities out there, and you simply respond if you're fit for one.
Absolutely, and actually that's how you and I met.
That's
so
how
thank,
we,
thank you to Peter Shankman of
right.
Help a Reporter Out.
And if you're on Twitter, he's at Skydiver, so he's very easy to find. But there are all kinds of things. So rather than pay for a public relations firm, and there are some great ones out there, and there are some who are reasonably priced, you can do, there are a lot of things you can learn to do for yourself. And that's really important right now, is to look for those low-cost options. Another thing that I always encourage my clients to do, but particularly now, is just like you're probably reviewing expenses at home, like I just dropped my HBO, don't need it anymore. I do weightlifting with a trainer, and I have a health club, and decided that was redundant. So I picked the one I use, which is the weight trainer, and I dropped the health club. I can rejoin. Of course, I negotiated that if I want to rejoin at any point in the future, there's no startup cost. I just get right back on my old rate, which is bargain basement rate. But you need to do that in your business as well. Look at those automatic renewals, which are so easy and are so great for many of us. If you're being hit with all kinds of withdrawals and payments and you're not using them, it's so easy that, you know, $25 or $250 or $300, that really adds up. And if you need it, it's smart, but if you don't need it, then you got to get rid of it. And not only that, but hard times for other people can mean great savings for you. So looking, renegotiating your phone service plan or some of your vendor pricing, this is the time to do all of that. And people are eager to do it. They'd rather do that than lose you.
Right.
So those things are very important. And those are all things that will allow you to put the emphasis back into your brand. And as much as the online tools and the digital tools are really important, I think this is not the time to cut back on the face-to-face networking. I think it's really important to, and when I say face-to-face, that doesn't necessarily mean in the same location. Get on the phone. Talk to people. Make your presence known. Get back in touch with all your former clients and customers. Make sure people know what's new and what you're up to lately and what you have to offer them. I think this is a critical time to step up your networking efforts.
Well, does everybody need a brand, no matter what kind of business they're in?
I think that they do, because, and it depends about how you think of it. If you consider your brand your reputation or image, certainly somebody in the corporate world needs a brand. And people at very senior levels often understand that because they've been interviewed, they've been profiled in the media, they've got a reputation, sort of a maybe a tagline that's kind of stuck and followed them through their career. But even people in the mid-level or just starting out need to understand that if you're, you know, there's somebody in the next cubicle who does very much what you do or maybe exactly the same thing you do. How do you, and this is not to be cutthroat or not to think that there's not room for everyone, but you need to establish your presence in a unique way. How do you do what you do with your unique personality, the gifts that you bring to the table? I mean, what is it that you offer? I interviewed the head of AOL Diversity for my podcast recently, and this lovely woman, Tianne Mitchell-Gordon, and she said to me, in the corporate world, it's no longer, we used to think of the melting pot, and now diversity is not about that, and I'll get back to, there's a branding point here, but it's really that you don't think of the melting pot as much as the gumbo, where everybody's unique flavors and spices mm-hmm. need to stand out. So if you're a 40-year-old Caucasian male and you're doing this job you've been doing for maybe 15, 20 years, that's one thing. If you're a 23-year-old Hispanic woman, you bring something different. Everybody brings something different to the table.
Right.
And this used to be, I used to sort of check half of my personality at the door in the corporate world because, you know, you were expected to put on your armor and go in and do battle. And I always found that very disturbing, and I'm happy to say with many of the corporations who I consult on corporate culture with, it's a very different attitude because we are hungry to know not only what all these individual people that make up your culture and your company have to bring to the table, but how do you market that? How do you use that to know what the coming trends are? What are young people thinking? What are your retiring boomers and traditionalists, your older workers doing that you can pass down to your younger workers? So it's really important to have that individual personal brand. And I think in the entrepreneurial or certainly in the small business world, it's pretty evident that you need to stand out. And again, if somebody offers the same, you're two consultants, say you're a consultant in the travel industry and so are they, what do you bring to the table that either they don't or they don't in the way that you do? And to be able to put to articulate that message of the unique value that you bring your customer is so critical. And it sounds so simple. It really sounds easy to do, but it really requires a lot of thought and a lot of crafting and wordsmithing to be able to do that.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about that a little bit last week when you were on my Transition Solutions show, and we were talking about personal branding. And we talked a little bit about what happens when people who are unemployed, go out and establish a consulting firm, and their brand is their name. And, I had just always felt I needed to make sure that the name of my firm actually said what I did. So when the URL solutions, with a Z, .com came available, I mean, I just had to snatch that up because, I mean, there was nothing better that described what I did of solving problems. And so, that was really important, I know, for me to set myself apart as somebody who was serious about consulting versus having it be kind of a transition step. Let's shift gears just a little bit and talk about, I know you have five specific strategies that you share with business owners and executives as a part of your coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Can you walk us through your five mindshare branding strategies?
Sure. The first thing in order to capture that mind share of your customer is that you must understand that you've got to live and breathe the brand. It must be uniquely and authentically who you are. And knowing what your gifts are and really getting feedback from your customers and clients, from colleagues, from people that you've worked with in the past about what your strengths are, what your value is, what you bring in a way no one else does. That's the first step. The second step is to stand out from the herd, and these times in particular when you're really people are hard-pressed to keep their doors open to keep business and cash flowing in, you've really got to be able to understand your marketplace differentiation. Understand what it is and then how you articulate that difference. So I'm going to choose solutions, these are always cool, by the way, so I applaud you for getting that. It's just memorable, and
yeah,
it puts a little spin and a little edge because we certainly see other companies that are strategic solutions or consulting solutions, but yours has that extra zing and pizzazz, and it makes it memorable and different, just that one little twist. The third thing you need to do, and this is where some of the really heavy lifting comes in, is you have to craft a sticky message. And by that, I mean something that is succinct, something that is memorable, something that people will readily understand so that they can identify who you are and they can get right away what you do. I've got this telecourse coming up, and I've got, I do a lot of, it's branding and building. It's all these market share, mind capturing the mind share and how that translates to market share. And I have a really interesting woman that I'm talking to, and she's going to join this class, and she's got a business where she trains, she does leadership training programs on horseback. She is an equestrian. And she's coming up with names, and boy, talk about a unique marketplace position. And she came up with a name, and it had something to do with horseplay, and I thought it was very clever and very cute, but I didn't get it. And I said, no, if I don't get in that five words or three words what you do, then it's not effective. So as clever as it is, you've got to throw it out. And in another group I was just talking to recently, I often when I talk to entrepreneurial groups, I'll throw out in my game, name that brand, and I'll have people stand up and give the group their branding message. It may be a positioning line that's on their website or on their letterhead. And this gal stood up very excited and said, oh, my gosh, I just nailed it right this minute. I want to see what you all think in front of this huge group. And she said, learning to rub people the right way. And first, the place cracked up, and I said, okay, it's got to be an instructional massage video. And she said, yes, That's
oh,
what it,
wow.
And I and everybody in the room got it immediately, thought it was really clever. It's short, it's succinct, and it just nailed what she did. And,
how funny is
and
that?
And nobody's going to forget it.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny because I am on the board of one of the travel industry's largest conferences called TravelCom. And I was saying at the last board meeting, you know, we've got to come up with a way to force the people who have booths at the trade show to actually say what it is that they do. Because you can walk around and you can look at actually their company name, and you can
mm-hmm.
even look at their verbiage that they have on the backdrop behind their booth.
And not have a clue.
Still not know
oh,
who
yeah.
they service, what they provide. And so we've come up with this solution for this year where, you know, we're going to talk about the travel ecosystem and, you know, who they serve within that ecosystem. And so, you know, if you're a hotelier and you're looking for stuff for hoteliers, you don't have to waste your time at the booth where they're dealing with, you know, airlines, or they're dealing with travel agencies or the corporate travel marketplace. And, you know, again, I think that that whole issue of succinct and memorable and sticky is very, very important even in that venue.
Well, it's funny. I've done this My Name That Brand at times, and one time somebody who was the corporate sponsor of the event stood up, and their name was across the entire back of the venue, which I didn't even notice, and it was insurance or financial services.
Right.
And their line was something like, helping you be more strategic. And I immediately said, okay, it could be insurance, could be healthcare, could be education, could be anything. And then I realized,
right.
oh, there you are, right in the back of the room, and you've been in business for 50 years. In that case, you know, it's working,
really?
Stick with
and
it.
And you spent $50,000 for a sponsorship.
There you go. You know what you could do with it? If there's a way to build in a sticky message competition and do something where people have to vote on who had the most succinct message, boy, you'd force people to get really creative really fast.
Well, since you're going to be the featured speaker at our luncheon event for the executive women, maybe we'll do just that.
Oh,
that would be fun.
Oh, I would love to challenge them to do that, because the truth is, busy people don't have time to figure it out. Why should you bother? Now, I sent out a newsletter yesterday, and I got one email back from somebody who said, do you know the header bleeds into the color? Now, I don't know if it was one person's computer or some kind of glitch between our two systems, because of all the thousands of other people, nobody else had a problem. But to me, that was one person too many. So I'm going to change the format and probably go to just a plain black and white, forget the pretty colors,
because
people don't have time to bother. Now, this person actually said to me, I cut and paste your newsletter because I really want to read it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm thrilled to have a loyal reader out there. But most people, that's a delete. And
right.
the same thing is if someone's walking around a trade floor, it's like, okay, if I can't get it at a glance, I'm going to the next booth because
definitely.
I get that. Or I'm going to skip it. And if I don't need to, if what you do is not relevant to me, better that that customer not waste your time as the booth owner or the vendor. It's better that they go on. I mean, I always think an immediate no is far better than a lingering maybe. If that's my line,
that.
Say no right up front and move on. Put the objections on the table, put the problem out there, and move on to someone who can help you. And in the world of small business in particular, if someone comes to you and they're not a fit, refer them to someone who is a fit. Not only will they thank you, but your colleague will thank you as well for sending that business their way. And
that's
really
terrific.
Important.
And then don't forget to send a thank you to the person who referred it.
Absolutely. 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 And that's how you build that colleague base. And
right.
get two
so
more. Oh,
yeah, I was going to say, what's strategy number four?
Strategy number four is to broadcast your brand. And that simply means once you've articulated that great message, you've nailed what it is you do and how you do it, you've got very clever or very serious, whatever your attitude is, you've got the message. How are you going to get it out there? And there are all kinds of ways you can use traditional media, but there are so many new opportunities for you in terms of social media and online, and learning how to broadcast your brand. And, of course, this was my expertise for many years. So learning how to pitch like a producer and think like an editor and communicate in the language that other people understand is critical to getting the word out, because you don't want to get lost in the shuffle, particularly now.
Right.
And to learn to do this yourself. And a lot of people they're afraid to pick up the phone and call the New York Daily News or the Chicago Tribune, but learning to think and pitch in a way that the media respects you and gets your message is
really, you know, we talked about Haro before. One of the greatest things that Peter Shankman has done is put together on his website a list of tips on how to pitch to the media.
Right, exactly.
And actually, if you subscribe to the Haro list, it actually shows you really great examples of how people want to be pitched to.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things I asked you last week was, you know, it's easy to establish a brand like Dr. Phil, and I love what you said when we first met, that, you know, you were able to get Dr. Phil, you know, mentioned more times in media than the Pope and the President combined. And but clearly you had a war chest that you were able to spend on that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do companies that may have in the past spent big bucks on traditional media, are there deals to be had right now in traditional media, or do you have to just go totally the viral, you know, guerrilla marketing approach?
Well, I think if you're not using guerrilla marketing and online tools, you're missing the boat, because that's not only where the low-cost tools are, but that's where the future of commerce is, and you really have to understand that. And for many companies, large and small, it's just a much more cost-effective way to do media business. But the most important thing, and, you know, a lot of my colleagues are authors and speakers, and they're actually quite surprised at how often I am seen in traditional media on the Today Show and CNN and those kinds of shows that are not easy to get on, Donny Deutsch. And it's really by understanding what producers are looking for and by doing their job for them. So it's not just having a very succinct email that you send to them or a quick pitch on the phone. It's what the essence of that is. How do you jump into timing that's important? How do you capitalize on bad news or good news that's out there? I do a lot of commenting on celebrity brands. For example, when Paul Newman passed away, I got a phone call from the Daily News in New York to ask if I thought his brand, Newman's own brand, would live on without him, which I do indeed, and that was not an issue. But for me, it was understanding what they were looking for, what the essence of the story would be, and giving them a quote that I knew was going to make the paper, that I thought would enhance the story. And it was really about, I said something about that he built a really great brand, and I quoted his line, which is something like shameless exploitation for the good of the masses or something like that,
right,
and suggested that people, you know, raise their glass of Newman's Own lemonade, and that was quoted. So understanding what people are looking for, and then if you're on the pitching end of it, making it so simple for, if you're pitching a talk show, for example, and of course everybody's big dream is, oh, I want to be on Oprah. If I had a dollar for every client that came to me and said, I want to be on Oprah, I would have retired long ago. Of course, that's the dream. But understanding what is it that you can do that no one else can, and how are you timing in, how are you adding into the breaking news of the day, or just the zeitgeist of what's happening in our culture. And of course, right now, it's about business. It's about layoffs. It's about where are you going to get your next job. And you need to be able to attach your brand in some way to that. And in every industry, in the travel industry, I'm sure you were talking about, I heard the tail end of that, but, you know, what are people looking for right now? I turn on the Today Show and they're talking about, you know, low-cost options or shoulder season or where you can get the best deals right now because people are hurting. And
well, let's go to your last one. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay.
You want to finish your thought?
No, I'm good. I'll go on. Chickie,
okay,
you wind
cool.
me up, and I'll go on forever.
No,
about
I love the last one, which is expanding your brand. And you know, you are instrumental both last week and today in helping me extend my brand. You know, I took the Solutions brand and, you know, tacked on the word live and created a social broadcasting network in which I can craft and create shows that can then be marketed you know, over and over again, and can actually be spread virally, which is what excites me about this. What else can you add about expanding your brand to help people understand? And we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I know I want to get you to tell us quickly about your telecourse.
Okay.
So,
Well, certainly in context of what's happening in the marketplace and the economy today, expanding your brand is about evolving and layering in different products and services that build and expand for your customer base. But right now, for a lot of people, it's looking at cost-effective solutions for your customers, because what they could afford 2 years ago or 6 months ago may not be what they're looking for now. People are desperate and hungry for things that are cost-effective, that are low-cost alternatives, whether you go from individual coaching to group coaching, things that you can do that give people what they want, that are really so that you're looking at not just your needs for your business, but what are your customers' needs? What are they dying for today? What are they going to need in a month and in 6 months and 3 years from now? So that's really about expanding your brand. It's listening, it's surveying, it's getting feedback, and it's really paying attention.
Well, that sounds really terrific. Now, I do know you've got a telecourse coming up. What can your participants expect to learn? And I think what I'd like to do is to go ahead and post the information about your teleconference on the Solutions Live site. So why don't you tell us about your teleconference?
Oh, that would be great. It starts on February 19th. And again, this was my clients told me, gee, I'd love to have one-on-one coaching, but I can't afford it now. What can you do? So I've started small groups. And we go through the basics of all the things that I was just talking about. I will personally review everybody's website. We look for that marketing message. Where is the gold in there? And if you've buried it below the fold, as they say, or somewhere on a jump page or a landing page and not right front and center where it smacks people in the face the minute they come to your site, that's a weakness. So we're going to look at ways to strengthen your message. We're going to look at your call to action. What are you asking your customers and your clients to do? I'm going to talk people through these basic tools of social networking so they learn to really use Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and find out how it works specific to them. And then I'm going to take them through a big picture thought process, and I've adapted this from a Harvard Business School study, where you look at a year from now, where do you want your company, your brand, your business to be in 1 year, and then we're going to back that out so that you've really got a working blueprint to move towards that in terms of branding and building.
Terrific. Well, Libby, thank you so much. I will put the specific information about your telecourse on the solutionslive.blogspot.com site. Thanks so much, and have a terrific day.
You too. Thank you, Chickie.
Okay.
For more information about Solutions Live, see www.solutions.live.blogspot.com. That's www.solutionslive.blogspot.com. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow at 10 a.m. Eastern for the social side of professional life.